You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The president just finished a speech about a half hour ago or so, a little bit longer than that, where he's talking about, you know, a new deal for the, well, a better deal for the middle class. And we'll get into that as we go on through the program. He laid out a suggestion with regard to corporate income taxes that I actually agree with. And even though it involves a tax cut, I'll share the details of that. I think he's pulling a John Kennedy here, and he's going to back the Republicans into a corner with it. We'll see how it plays out. The Bradley Manning trial just came to a verdict. The judge convicted him of 19 charges, including 5 charges of espionage, but on the Whopper charge, the aiding and abetting the enemy charge, which could have led to life in prison or even the death sentence, he was acquitted. And we are hopeful that Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights, basically Julian Assange's attorney, will be available to come on the program in about 10 minutes. So we'll see if he has not. He's, as you can imagine, it's an insane day for Michael. And but he's, you know, so we'll be covering that. And meanwhile, I mean, this whole, you know, Bradley Manning, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden now, I mean, a lot of this stuff, there are folks who are saying that the Arab Spring happened because, I mean, not folks, good, you know, fairly intelligent commentators. The Arab Spring happened in part because of cables released by Bradley Manning to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks via the New York Times to the world. And so, you know, might this be a net positive? We're discovering now you've got, I mean, just if 7 Republicans or Democrats had changed their vote last week, we would have defunded the NSA, spying on every, you know, taking, accumulating the metadata of every single person in America's phone information. So it seems to me like there's a sea change happening with libertarians and liberals forming a block against the old establishment conservatives and neoconservatives on the right, and the establishment Democrats and the military-industrial complex on both the left and the right. So Ryan Morrow is with us. He's national security analyst with the Clarion Project, clarionproject.org, the founder of worldthreats.com, adjunct professor of terrorism. His website is clarionproject.org. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Tom.
Great to have you with us. The note I have here suggests that you support these NSA programs. I'm wondering how, given what we know about this now, and given, you know, people from Ron Wyden on the left, within the Senate, the far left, to Rand Paul on the far right, saying, wait a minute, this is not what the Fourth Amendment says. And I'm assuming that you're familiar with the language of the Fourth Amendment. If not, I'd be pleased to read it to you. But, you know, I'm assuming you are, that I don't see how gathering information on any of us in any way that could at some point in time be used in any kind of criminal proceeding against us without a warrant is constitutional.
Well, the bottom line is that the Fourth Amendment is referring to personal property, and you do not own those phone records. I do not own the records that Verizon keeps of what numbers called what numbers and how long those conversations took place. And overall, I think that this really is just a lot of hype. It's really been caused by a lot of sensationalistic media, because your private phone calls are not being listened to. They're not being recorded on. It's not like if you're having a fight with your boyfriend or girlfriend that they are listening in on that. They are not recording the content of the conversations. And this program makes sense to me, because if you get an Al-Qaeda member's cell phone from overseas and you want to see who called that number, you have to have a way to do that.
And you go to a judge and you get a warrant.
Who called them?
Well, you go to a judge and you get a warrant.
Well, this is, well, yeah, in order to wiretap them, but you don't have to get a judge's permission in order to, once you get the Al-Qaeda member's cell phone, to plug it into a database and then see who called them. At that point, once you can see who called them, then you can have the necessary information to go get a warrant so you can wiretap them.
So you're asserting that because the financial relationship that has evolved over the years between us and our phone companies is such that all of us presumably at some point have agreed to a shrink wrap contract kind of thing, or a click wrap contract or whatever, that says that the numbers that we have called, the information about who we called and when we called them, is not our property. It is the property of the telephone company. Then that therefore the telephone company has, I'm still missing it, because according to the Supreme Court, the telephone company is a person too. And corporations have on many occasions gone before the Supreme Court and petitioned for Fourth Amendment privacy rights, and the Supreme Court has granted them. So why should my privacy rights, you know, if my privacy rights can't be violated except by court order, why should Verizon's?
I think that's more of a fair argument, because basically what you do have happening is the government coming in and taking the records of a private company, and then that is, to be honest with you, that is something I'm a little uncomfortable with. But then I think about how police have issued subpoenas in order to get the information in order to build probable cause from phone records in the past, and this doesn't seem that much different than that.
Well, I don't have a problem with a subpoena. A subpoena is a process that involves a judge. It's acceptable under the Fourth Amendment.
This has a judge. Every 3 months, this has to get approved by the FISA court.
Right, but the FISA court, 100% of the members have been appointed by John Roberts, who I think that in and of itself is a huge mistake, to have one person be the gatekeeper for the entire court system that's protecting not only our national security but our national privacy. It seems crazy. I mean, you may love John Roberts, I don't. But, you know, what if, on the other hand, it was Ruth Bader Ginsburg? I mean, this just seems like a really, really bad way to create a court, number one.
Well, I think the conversation has to be about how to reform the program and not scrap it. I mean, obviously, if there's a suggestion on how to make the program better in a way that's more comfortable to more Americans, then by all means have that discussion. But right now,
I think that's what we're doing right now.
Completely cutting it off and just scrapping it, and I think that that's just going too far. And this is a
well, no. What Congress was saying, Verizon's going to, and AT&T and all the other companies, these other giant monopolies, they're going to continue to keep our phone metadata for as long as they want to. And there's nothing you or I could do about that. I mean, we could try to have a conversation about that with them, and there may be the DuckDuckGo's of the telephone world. DuckDuckGo, I did a half-hour conversation with the founder of DuckDuckGo on TV last week for our Conversations with Great Minds. I believe his name is Gabriel Weinberg, and it's over at conversationswithgreatminds.com right now. And this is a search engine that doesn't track you, doesn't keep track of all your data, your metadata, your searches, all that other kind of stuff. And, it's possible that a phone company might come along and say, we're going to compete based on the fact that we don't snoop on you, we don't keep your information. But that's a kind of a separate conversation, although I think it's one that probably we should have.
No,
but
I agree.
You're
with that.
Saying that you're okay with the government, and I thought conservatives didn't like the government gathering all this information, when the information is always available to the government if they can simply prove need. They've got to come to AT&T or Verizon or whatever the company is with a subpoena, with a warrant.
Well, the problem is that in order to get the warrant, you have to say, I want to get the information on this specific individual. But you have no way of knowing who that specific individual is if you can't search the database. And there's only 22 analysts at the NSA.
No, that's only half of the equation.
In order to search the database. So that's also important to understand. That's not like you have thousands of people just going through all of your phone records.
So the camel's nose under the tent is just fine, and we're going to now have a conversation about someday it's going to be the whole camel?
Oh, I think it's worth having that conversation.
Okay. All right. Ryan Morrow, clarionproject.org. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
Thanks for dropping by. We will continue this conversation as time goes on. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Bradley Manning, hero or goat? I think this is we'll see what the sentence comes down. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and on the line with us live right now, Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights and the U.S. lawyer for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The website for the Center for Constitutional Rights, CCR, as in Center for Constitutional Rights, CCRjustice.org. And Michael, welcome back to the program.
Tom, it's always good to be with you.
It is always an honor to have you, sir. So tell us what happened with Bradley Manning and your thoughts on this trial's outcome.
There were 22 counts. He was facing 154 years, plus another count, the 22nd count, which was the aiding the enemy, which was life in prison, even the death penalty. Of the 22 counts, he got convicted or pled guilty to 20 of them. On two, he was acquitted. The main one and the important one, and of course it's the only good news in this sad saga, is he got acquitted of the aiding the enemy charge. That's the one that carried life in prison. It was the most serious charge, and it's the one in which would have deeply affected, in a way that was really nasty, every single journalist and whistleblower in the country, because what it was saying is that a whistleblower who gives information to whether it's Tom Hartman or the New York Times or WikiLeaks can be guilty of aiding the enemy because the enemy might listen to Hartman or they might read the New York Times or they read the web and read WikiLeaks. So that would have been an utter disaster. It was a completely overcharged case, and the judge had taken out the requirement that you had to have intent to aid the enemy. So we're glad he was acquitted on that. It's not a small deal. It's a big deal. It's a big deal that it was fought against by a lot of us. They're saying this is outrageous. On the other hand, it's also a big deal in a bad way of what he was convicted of. He was convicted of, as I said, of 20 charges. Five of those are espionage. Five are theft of government documents. Total sentence could be up to 134 years. Over the next two or three weeks, we're going to see the sentencing proceeding happening in which both sides present why the government claims it wants a high sentence, while the defense says he should get a lower sentence. The awful part of this, of course, is we have a man who was a major whistleblower, Bradley Manning, who released information that all of us should know about a secret government, about secret torture chambers in Iraq, about documents that actually began the Arab Spring, arguably, in Tunisia, about 20,000 extra civilians killed in Iraq, which was led to the Iraq government refusing to renew the status of forces agreement with the U.S. so that it actually forced our troops out of Iraq. And you have Bradley Manning facing 134 years, and you have the people who perpetrated those crimes, from the collateral murder video people, that's the Apache helicopter that killed the two Reuters journalists and 11 or 10 others, to those people, to those who ran the torture centers, those people, none of them have been investigated or prosecuted for their crimes, and yet you see the whistleblower, Bradley Manning, who is supposed to be telling us, who has told us, along with WikiLeaks who published it, what we need to know about our government. That's what's being prosecuted.
Yeah, and many of the people who perpetrated these crimes, President Bush and many of those in his administration did so for the basest of political reasons, i.e. to gain political power. Bush came right out and said it, that he thought the war in Iraq would give him enough political capital that he could privatize Social Security. And the corporate perpetrators, the people running the torture centers, were doing it for the worst of possible capitalist reasons, which was pure profit. And as you say, none of these people are being investigated at all. Are there any indications? I know the Center for Constitutional Rights has worked very hard to try to bring some of the people from the Bush administration to justice on this. How goes that?
You know, that it's going. I mean, we still have a case pending in Spain against the Bush torture team. It's going slowly. I think the biggest thing that happened in the last few days, of course, was the arrest briefly of the CIA head from Italy, Robert Lady is his name, Robert Selden Lady. He was arrested briefly and held in Panama on the grounds that he'd been convicted of a kidnapping, a rendition by the United States in Italy of an Egyptian cleric named Abu Omar. Unfortunately, Robert Lady was put on a plane back to the United States. Panama wasn't about to counter the United States. So these CIA people, at least, that arrest sent a message. You leave the United States at your jeopardy. There's some 500 agents, we believe, involved in the in what I call the torture program. So those people are at least confined to the U.S. So that's how it's going. So we're having that movement, but, you know, the government is what it's doing to whistleblowers right now, what it did to Bradley Manning, what it, of course, is trying to do to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And the trial of Bradley Manning was interesting on that, because what came out in that trial was that they are really after WikiLeaks. They consider WikiLeaks a co-conspirator with Bradley Manning. They actually said Bradley Manning was taking direction from WikiLeaks. No evidence of that at all. But that's what they're saying. And so they're going after not just whistleblowers, but publishers as well. We know that with the case of a guy named James Rosen, a Fox News reporter. His telephone records were subpoenaed on the grounds that he was a co-conspirator with his whistleblower source. So you're getting the government trying to push close together whistleblowers and publishers. The aiding the enemy charge was obviously a major attempt to do that. But the Obama administration really has made an unprecedented attempt to just squash any kind of truth-telling about the nature of our own government.
In the minute we have left, Michael Ratner, Center for Constitutional Justice, ccrjustice.org. Any thoughts on how our listeners and viewers might be able to respond in a way that would be supportive of freedom of the press?
Well, there's two ways, but the big one is actually go to the Bradley Manning Support Network page, which is Bradley Manning Support, and you'll find a lot of activities from asking for a pardon to petitions to getting there to court if you can at Fort Meade, which you can go to. I've gone to a lot of the trial sessions. Very, very crucial to do that. I think he needs the support. Look, this is a young man who's a hero who's facing 134 years in prison. He needs all the support, and we have to show this country, and particularly its government, that people who tell us the truths about our own government are people who have to be listened to and not persecuted.
Yeah. And you said there were two things. That's the first.
Oh, the second is there is a major speech happening in the Washington area on August 4th. It's going to be Cornel West, Chris Hedges, and others talking about Bradley Manning. I'm sure it'll be live streamed. Very, very important. They're very strong on it.
Okay.
And he needs support.
Keep an eye out for that. Michael Ratner, the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccrjustice.org. Michael, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Great talking. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Well, things are moving along at a lightning speed. We'll see how the Republicans respond to Mr. Obama's I up you one JFK. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, a lot going on. The president, let me just fill you in here on the president's speech. Of course he once more said, please give me the authority to present a free trade deal to Congress and force them to do an up or down vote on it, which I strongly object to. So-called fast tracking the transatlantic trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. These deals being cut by big corporations in secret without input from our elected officials, and they will be presented to our elected officials on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. And even though he starts out in one of his speeches, with a little riff about how our trade deals have helped us. Where did it go here? Yeah, here we are. Number four, jobs exporting our goods around the world. 1 year after I signed a new trade agreement with Korea, our big three automakers were selling 18% more cars there. Well, isn't that special? We still have the world's largest trade deficit, the largest trade deficit in the history of planet Earth. We are still importing more than we are selling. We are still consuming more than we are making. We are still, on a tragic and disastrous road. Now, he points out that this is the first time this year is the first year since the 1990s that we've actually exported more than we've imported. This is the first year that manufacturing has actually grown, which, is a pretty big deal. Here we go. Today, our businesses have created 7.2 million new jobs over the last 40 months. This year, we're off to our best private sector job growth in 1999. That was not the place where it was. But in any case, he points out we haven't seen an increase in manufacturing since the 90s, and we're starting to see an increase in manufacturing. That's a good thing, but still, Yeah, okay. He says, over the past 4 years, for the first time since the 1990s, the number of manufacturing jobs hasn't gone down, it's gone up. Now we have to build on that progress. You think? So that's what I disagree with. You know, I think that we should do that by returning to basically protectionist trade policies. But that said, you know, what he's saying to the Republicans, they're saying, you know, you got this 35% income tax rate for corporations, and it's the highest in the developed world. Why don't you cut it? And, of course, the real income tax rate, the amount that corporations are actually paying, is 11%. And so, you know, I agree. You know, why keep it at 35% when nobody's paying that? So he says, let's cut it down to 28% and close the loopholes, which is what Jack Kennedy said in 1962 and 63 about the top income tax rate of 91% back then. He said, cut it down to 70% and close the loopholes and you'll make more money. And we did. We saw a 60% increase over the next 5 years in income tax collections because rich people didn't have loopholes anymore. So this is the kind of it's the kind of deal that I think that might be a good idea. The devil's always the details. Wait until the sausage gets made in Congress, and I may well have a different opinion. But in principle, it sounds to me like, you know, another Jack Kennedy kind of deal, which was a relatively moderate compromise, basically. The Republicans got the tax cut they wanted. The Democrats got the loopholes closed. Everybody's happy. Nancy in Chicago. Hey, Nancy, you wanted to talk about privacy and data collection?
Yes, I was thinking about what your guest said, and I thought, you know, how far does this go? If we rent a car or lease a car, does the GPS get collected on us and that the car company knows where we've been?
They do.
And
yes.
They
have the ability to. I don't know that they're tracking that right now, but they have the ability to, yes.
Right, and same with cable TV, or like I have OnStar, so I pay for it. But so that means that the government can know exactly where I've been. So it seems like now that it's all everything, you have to pay for everything, or we have more services.
Right.
It's so much easier for them to track us. But then we hear all the time, well, as Mitt Romney says, corporations are people. Well, then the corporation should have the same rights to privacy.
Yeah. This is where it gets complicated because on the one hand, I don't want the government collecting all these massive amounts of data, period. I mean, I'm with the libertarians and the absolute far right crazies, the Rand Pauls of the world on this. I agree. The federal government and state and local governments, police agencies, shall we say, should only be policing criminals. Or suspected criminals. If they want to know everything about me, every place I've been, everybody I've talked to, every letter I've sent, I don't have a problem with that if they have evidence that I've committed a crime, or you or anybody else. But if they don't have that evidence, if nobody's willing to go in before a judge and raise a hand and swear under oath that they have, you know, probable cause and some evidence to indicate that somebody's engaged in a crime, I don't think that our government should be accumulating that data, which then leaves it to the corporations. And you said you have OnStar. That means that General Motors or whoever made your car, or just the good folks at OnStar itself, which is a separate private corporation, have the ability to not only know where you are at all times and to know what your car is doing at all times, you know, whether the doors are locked and what speed you're going and everything else. They also have the ability to listen inside your car at any time. And because there's a microphone and a transmitter attached to OnStar. And it's not just OnStar. And there's this black box in your car that increasingly they're starting to use. They're downloading the data from it, which includes conversations in the car that they're using to determine, well, this person was speeding at the time of this accident, or this person was texting at the time of or having a phone conversation at the time of this accident, that kind of thing. And so then you've got the question of, well, who owns this information? Well, clearly right now the corporations own that information. I'm of the opinion that if Reagan had not stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1982, if we had not had 30 years of corporate aggregation to the point where there really is no competition in the auto industry, there is no competition in the cell phone business, there is no competition in pretty much any major industry in the United States, that if we were still in the era as for example, European countries are, where they enforce competition. You can buy your cell phone service in France from almost 100 different companies, or Germany, or pretty much any other European country. If we were in that kind of an era, then I would bet my bottom dollar that somebody would start a company, and if they didn't, I would start a company saying, we'll offer you cell phone service with a guarantee that we only keep your records until you've paid your bill. In other words, the only thing that we need to know about you is what we're going to bill you for, and after your check is cleared, it goes through the shredder. And people would start buying that service, and it wouldn't just be the Gotti gang, you know, it would be people who are interested in privacy. And the same thing, you know, there might be a competitor to OnStar who would come along and say, you know, we will sign a contract with you saying we will never listen, and we will only turn this over under subpoena, and we will not keep it for more than 30 days or whatever. But right now, because of the monopolies, nobody feels the pressure to do that. And so really, because we're in a monopolistic situation, the only way to get that kind of privacy from corporations is to legislate it via government, because government is, you know, the monopoly of governance dealing with the monopoly of corporations. And that means that we've got to hit a critical mass of people being upset. Am I making sense here, Nancy?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you for the call. Thanks for raising the topic. It's an important one. I appreciate it. Tony in Pompano Beach, Florida. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you. Hey, I'm thinking about this NSA wiretapping and all, and the question comes to my mind, why do the phone companies retain my phone records? Why is it important for them to remember that last month I called Aunt Susie in Des Moines 14 times? Why do they retain that information? Why is that
forever?
They could defeat the entire program if they just didn't do it. And then, but so there must be some collusion between the government and through the company somehow or another. Some arrangement must be
The companies keep that information because it has the potential and the current reality to make them money. In some cases, they might want to sell that information. You know, they would compile, you know, phone numbers, lists of phone numbers, sell those to people who are buying them for telemarketing or for political purposes or whatever. But perhaps more importantly, and not perhaps, certainly more importantly, I know this for a fact, the phone companies will take, you know, a couple of years worth of this metadata and put it in giant models, giant computer models, to figure out what are the patterns of phone usage so that they can tailor their plans. Where, I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but when Watts lines first rolled out, they had, you know, 800 numbers, only outbound 800 numbers. They had inbound for that matter. They had five zones across the country, and different zones had different prices and all that kind of stuff. This all came out of this kind of modeling. And so they will model it so that they can design usage plans that are right up to the edge of what you need. In other words, if they know that the number of minutes that the average person uses is 116.5, then they're going to say, okay, our minimum plan is 110 minutes, so everybody's going to think they're going to be just fine. But then it's an extra $60 to go to 150 minutes, right? And in other words, they'll figure out a way to get right at that threshold where most people are going to either pay a little more than they would like to, or they're going to get dinged. And that's what they use the metadata for. Make sense?
Yeah, and you know, it ties in with, you know, U.S. sees everybody as their enemy. You, me, everybody.
Right, and corporations see all of us as suckers, basically. You know, how can we squeeze another buck out of this guy? Tony, thank you for the call. And they also use it for marketing. You know, how do we design marketing programs and marketing advertising campaigns, things like that. But that's principally what the phone companies use that information for.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And to project trends into the future based on trends in the past and all that kind of stuff. It's not, you know, necessarily evil stuff, but I'd like to be able to say no. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 10 minutes before the hour, a visit or two ago to Portland, I was at a gig that featured the Zimbabwe Artists Project. They are doing incredible work. And Teresa Burks is with us. The website is Zimbabwe Artists, plural, with an S, project.org. Zimbabwe Artists Project.org, or with an S possessive. And Teresa, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here with you.
And you are actually in Zimbabwe right now?
I am.
Great. So tell us about the Zimbabwe Artist Project. What are you doing?
So What we do is we work with mainly women artists to help them increase their ability to sell their art, which will then increase their self-sufficiency so that they can take care of themselves and their families. And we also work with them on their health care. We do health care assistance, and we have an education assistance program where we help children who have been orphaned in the area where we work, which is in eastern Zimbabwe in an area called Weya.
Zimbabwe is one of the poorest countries in the world. This is one of the places, talk about identifying places of great need. How did the Zimbabwe Artists Project come about, Teresa?
Well, it started when a professor of sociology from Lewis and Clark College in Portland, named Dick Adams, when he took a group of students to Zimbabwe, and he heard about the artists, and he met with them, and he was, you know, just impressed with their art, and they do board paintings, fabric paintings, embroideries, and appliques. Mm-hmm. And so he met with them, and some of the students stayed with some of the artists as host families during their stay there. And he came back to Zimbabwe three different times with groups of students. And on one of his visits, the artist said, "Will you help us sell our art in America?" And he said, "Well, I'll give it a try." Mm-hmm. And that's how the Zimbabwe Artist Project started.
That is great. Can people at ZimbabweArtistsProject.org actually find art there?
So I'm sorry. When I'm here in Zimbabwe, mm-hmm. I meet with the artists and I purchase art from them. Mm-hmm. We also work with a gentleman here who is Zimbabwean, who works with on our behalf with the artists year round, and so he is meeting with them. So I'm here for about 5 weeks, and then he meets with them for the rest of the year and purchases their art and sends it to us.
That's absolutely marvelous. So people can have access to this in the United States and support the project. Teresa Birx, anything you'd like to add, Teresa, about this?
Just that people should feel free to come to our website, because we do have an online gallery so people can actually see the art and read about the artists and read about our project and what we do, and feel free to contact us via email.
Great.
We'd love to hear from people.
That's ZimbabweArtistsProject.org, Teresa Birx. Teresa, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks so much for being with us and for the great work that you're doing and for calling in from Zimbabwe. It's extraordinary. Catherine in New York City, listening on WWRL. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've come to the conclusion that the government is theater, that we are owned by certain corporations, international as well as domestic, and that the spying, all of that is because people are going to get fed up when they get a job for $1 an hour with no education. You know, that if people try to organize anything to stop this, they've got everything on us. You know?
Yeah.
And 9/11, I went to a very good symposium 2 years ago at a church, and they had scientists. Physicists, architects, engineers, explosive experts. There is no way that it happened the way they said it did.
Yeah. Well, that's a topic, Catherine, that is, I think, widely open to debate, and we'll debate some other time. But I do agree with you. That said, I absolutely agree with you that if you want to go up against corporate power in this country, they now know everything. And I think, frankly, that's worse than the NSA knowing everything. Audrey in Seattle is on KBCS. Hey, Audrey.
Hi. I wanted to ask three quick things all related about the cost to the taxpayers of the NSA surveillance.
Right.
It seems kind of weird to be paying to be spied on.
Yes.
I'm not as concerned about privacy right now. And then there's also that enormous facility, I gather, that where the United States government is putting up in Utah to store all this stuff.
Yep.
And it's going to use a huge amount of electricity because it's going to be a big pile of
computers. Yeah.
And that's going to, in my opinion, be a big waste of money and natural resources to produce the electricity. And then the third one is how long are they going to keep it? And, you know, it's because they'll have to be, keep making it bigger and bigger and bigger. Do they know somebody dies?
Well, there's Moore's Law. You know, as time goes on, technology improves, and the ability to store more and more in a smaller and smaller space at a lower and lower price is relatively continuous. So I think that the amount of time that they can store it is probably going to be, for as long as they damn well please, or infinite, and or certainly all of our lifetimes. And with regard to cost, you and I are not allowed to know that. We are mere mortals. We are just the ants in the anthill. And the NSA does not disclose their budget. There are some members of Congress who are familiar with it, who are on the intelligence committees and are have access to the briefings. But by and large, they get all the money they want, whenever they want it, to do whatever they want. And, you know, with very, very little oversight. Although that is not just true of the NSA. It's true largely of the entire military-industrial complex, which is mind-boggling when you think about it, particularly when you think about all the need there is in this country. I mean, just genuine human need. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The president has just laid out his economic vision for America, offered a deal to the Republicans. I'll cut corporate tax rates if you'll close corporate tax loopholes. Very interesting stuff. Peter Ferrara has been writing about President Obama over at Forbes.com. Peter is a senior fellow with the Carlson Center for Public Policy, the author of America's Ticking Bankruptcy Bomb, the website theccpp.org, ccpp.org. I have that right, Peter?
Yes.
Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. Your last article I found really interesting, and I just genuinely wanted to ask you about this. You start out by talking about how Obama is, you say the magician's trick is deception. Obama's deceiving us. In his economic policy speech last week at Knox College in Galesville, Illinois, you say he talks a lot about championing the middle class, a ploy he learned from Saul Alinsky, which is a vaguely Russian-sounding name or maybe a Jewish-sounding name or something. I guess it's supposed to be sinister. And then for Barack Obama, you write, the whole purpose of his public life is to foist the leftist ideology of his father on a mesmerized American public. This is what you were writing at Forbes. Really?
Yes.
And tell me about it.
So that's obvious, but he's governing on an Americanized version of Marxism. He's taking it as far as he possibly can in the American system, and he's doing a very good job of it if you're a communist. But he's not interested in the middle class. He said in his speech, he's for good jobs, quote, good jobs, a better bargain for the middle class and folks working to join it, an economy that grows from the middle out.
Right.
Well, where's that been for 5 years as president?
It's been obstructed by Republicans.
We have middle class income declining for the entire time Obama has been president.
Mm-hmm.
Middle class incomes are down the equivalent of a month's pay a year.
Yep. Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, yes.
Instead of good jobs, America's under transition to part-time jobs.
Yep, Mitch McConnell.
The number of full-time jobs actually declined. All the new jobs created last month were part-time jobs.
Kevin
McCarthy. No wonder middle-class incomes are declining because you can't earn a good income with just a part-time job.
Yeah, Pete Hookster.
Instead of an economy growing from the middle out, we've had under Obama for 5 years now an economy that has effectively not been growing at all.
Pete Sessions, yes.
Pete Sessions is not president.
No, well, there on the night that the president was inaugurated, There were 14 Republicans who got together: Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker at the Caucus Room Restaurant here in Washington, D.C. And they plotted a plan that has been written about in several books now to stop this president from having any kind of economic success during his presidency. And in fact, one of their members, Kevin McCarthy, said, "We've got to challenge them on every single bill, show united and unyielding opposition to the president's economic policies." He said that on the record. And another one, Congressman Pete Sessions, said, "We're understanding this from the Taliban. This is a Taliban insurgency. We need to understand that insurgency is required when dealing with the other side. We will become the Taliban insurgency. The insurgency is a mindset."
That must have been a very interesting meeting, because on the night President Obama was inaugurated, the Republicans had exactly zero power.
I know.
In Congress.
I know.
And so.
And they were
really
plotting how to get it back, and they did a very, very good job.
Well,
so
really,
So you're saying that it's President Obama's communism and Marxism that has caused the economy to be in the crapper for 5 years. I would think if he was really a communist or a Marxist, he would nationalize some of our industries. Like, you know, just take ExxonMobil, for example, and you know, the hundreds of billions in profits that they make, nationalize it, like many countries have done. I mean, Norway did this, right? And nationalize it and say, this is now the property of the people, or semi-nationalize it the way that Sarah Palin did up in Alaska, where you say, you know, we're going to tax you fairly heavily on all that oil you take out of the ground. And every year, you know, as you, I'm sure you know, Sarah Palin wrote a check to every single citizen in Alaska, whether they were 2 years old or 102 years old, a check for a little over $2,000 out of oil revenues. Why isn't he doing that kind of stuff? Because that would provide an immediate stimulus.
Smart socialists know that you don't need to nationalize anything anymore. You just take it over by regulation. So mm-hmm. he's already done that with the healthcare industry. He's already done that with the financial industry. He's already done that with much of the energy industry. And so he's making his progress that way. But policy he's followed has been anti-growth. Higher tax rate, more regulation, increased government spending, deficits and debt, and a weak dollar monetary policy. That's four proponents guaranteed. If we follow that, America will be Argentina in a matter of time. It's just a matter of time.
Well, it would take a military dictator to make us Argentina. Or you mean right. Contemporary Argentina, which is doing quite well right now. Thank you very much. Argentina 2000.
Well, I mean, right. The AFL-CIO folks can just go to Argentina. That's great, because we don't prevent them from doing that. So if you think Argentina is doing great.
Well, there are a lot of cooperatives.
It's a country with a very poor standard of living, and that's where we're going if we continue to follow these anti-growth policies.
Well, I think they're doing great compared to where they've been and compared to some of the countries around them. But I still don't get the communist part. And in fact, maybe I can. I mean, you wrote about this. You said, the truth is Obama disdains economic growth in the middle class. What he treasures is the neediness of government dependency. That, you know, presumably because more people are on food stamps and unemployment now than ever before, that's what you're talking about. Do I have that right, Peter?
He's taking the Chicago political machine model national. So he wants government dependency so he can trade government handouts for votes. And
right.
So that is why food stamps has been run up so much. That's why Medicaid is being run up so much. He wants people dependent on the government. He wants as many people on welfare as possible, because he figures if you're on welfare, the Democrat Party owns you, and you will vote Democrat for the rest of your life. And
okay. Okay, I understand that. After the last Republican great crash in 1929, you know, through the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt came along, and he did exactly what you're saying. He passed out jobs. He hired 12 million people between 1933 and 1940, before World War II. He passed out food. He did exactly what you're describing, and people loved him for it, reelected him over and over again. But as soon as the economy recovered, those people dropped, you know, they quit the CCC and the WPA to go to work for General Motors and Motor Wheel and Chrysler. And I mean, they immediately went to the private sector as soon as there were openings, as soon as the private sector had recovered. Why do you think, how is President Obama going to keep people in chains if the economy does recover and keep them from doing what people did in the 50s?
Well, see, that's exactly my point. See, when they became middle class, they became Republicans. And now you see that all over the world. The middle class is politically independent because they're financially independent. But under Obama's policies, it's not going to recover. That sent the headline of my column. There's a boom in this economy, lurking at the end of Obama's second term. Because every policy he's followed is anti-growth. High tax rate, increased government regulation, weak dollar monetary policies, roaring government spending deficits and debt. And so it's all discouraging to the economy, and you're not going to have economic growth as long as you're following that. And you've got now 5 years.
And yet, at the same time, these things are.
The data shows a weaker recovery than for any other recovery since the Great Depression.
Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor. Yes, I agree. And the Republicans are doing a very good job of blocking everything he's tried to do. I'm totally with you.
One policy that would have created jobs that the Republicans.
And I agree with you that when he leaves office. If the Republicans stop obstructing him, if they go back to like when George Bush was president and just start saying, hey, let's go on a spending spree, or like when Ronald Reagan was president, you're going to see an economic boom. I agree
with
you.
There's not one policy that would have created jobs that the Republicans have stopped. Not one.
Okay. How about his jobs bill that they're filibustering?
They already did that. They did the similar stimulus bill and come back and do half as much again.
No, I mean
that's a good idea. That's not worthy of a president of the United States.
Peter, we're running out of time here. Thank you for dropping by theCCPP.org. Thank you, Peter. Peter Ferrara.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, Obama, Kenyan socialists? Maybe. But I don't know how it's going to work long term. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. And Catherine in Madison, Wisconsin, you have an update on the arrests going on in the Wisconsin state capitol. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Right. It started last week. They arrested 80 people for not having a permit at the sing-along. The feeling is that the Constitution is our permit.
Now, hang on just a second. Before we go any farther, why don't you describe for our viewers and listeners what the sing-along is?
Okay. For over 750 days from Monday through Friday for the last 2.5 years, people have spontaneously come to the Capitol at noon, from noon to 1 o'clock, to sing songs. It used to be about the recall. Now it's about protest in general of what's going on in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Our Capitol has a history of being the most open Capitol in the United States. It was, even after 9/11, it was an open Capitol. And the bottom floor, the ground floor of the rotunda, is a place that traditionally people have been able to come and protest the government,
mm-hmm.
or even show support of the government.
Sure.
So about 2 years ago, they told us that we were going to need a permit. They took us to a re-education meeting where Jocelyn Webster, who is now the right-hand person of Walker, who was a Karl Rove protege, laughed when she said no one will ever get arrested. So over the last year and a half, there's been over 150 tickets, a half a dozen arrests.
Wow.
Last
tickets are for what, loitering and trespassing kind of thing?
Let's see. Not loitering, blocking entrances. Mm. It's in the round. So, like,
right.
They say you're blocking with your sign, or signs have been illegal, all sorts of things like that have been going on. So they decided... Chief Warren took over from Chief Tubbs about a year ago when we had those re-education meetings, and they were telling he decided to crack down a couple weeks ago. They'd been filming for about 6 months so they could do facial recognition. That's what they did with those other tickets. They were not directly giving them to people. They were going to their houses, their place of business, or putting them in the mail.
I see.
So they took the film. They did facial recognition, I assume, against the DMV records. So now we're in the second stage of this where they're giving the tickets directly. But while they're giving them directly, they take you in plastic cuffs. And every day those cuffs have been getting tighter and tighter, and they've been getting rougher and rougher with people. Last week, they arrested an 80 and 85-year-old, the Kimballs, Tom and Joan. Their daughter happens to be Rebecca Kimball, who writes for The Progressive. You could read about that at theprogressive.org. They arrested two media people last week, a Franciscan monk and a Lutheran minister who had a heart issue, and it took 20 minutes for the EMS to get to him, and the EMS are 3 minutes or 5 minutes away.
Mm.
They when one mother was arrested, she took her 5-year-old with her. They patted down the 5-year-old and asked him if he had any sharp objects. He's not traumatized at all. We got him a cape and a saber, and he has his own sign, and he knows why okay. he's there.
Right.
As a matter of fact, she said he wiggled and said, "Oh, that feels good." So don't yeah. worry about him, people. The 5-year-old's fine.
There you go.
They also last week snatched away the crutch from another person that they were taking away. She had just recently had a hip operation, and Officer Calhoun said that he was in EMS and she'd be fine. As you could see, she was in pain. There, wow. You can see it. There's pictures
so,
online.
So the Scott Walker administration, the Republican administration in Wisconsin, is starting to really tighten the screws and make it painful and difficult for people to protest at the Capitol.
Well, yes. I mean, he's going to be running for president. The world
yes.
press will be there. The U.S. press will be there. He doesn't want anybody there. The Chinese are coming in to buy up Wisconsin. He doesn't want dissidents in the Capitol.
Mm.
So today, 30 were arrested. The first was Tom Kimball again, the 85-year-old gentleman. Reverend Carter didn't even make it out of the rotunda. We don't know if he was being arrested or he just had another cardiac issue, but he was on the floor for about 15 minutes, and it was before the EMS showed up. And someone said they were a medical professional, and they would not let her near him.
Wow.
So they had so many people downstairs. Now, mind you, these are tickets. So, of course, again, they did not have to use restraints on them, and everybody was peaceful during arrest and downstairs. So they had so many people down there from the sing-along that they were singing. The chief came down and told them that they needed to cease and desist, and they listened for a second, and then they went right back to singing.
Mm-hmm.
We know that we're there for everybody's rights. We know that Alec and Karl Rove are deeply embedded in this state, and so are the
Koch brothers. And the Koch brothers, yeah.
And the Koch brothers, yep, and we know that. And so those people, including that 5-year-old, are there for everyone's rights.
Mm-hmm.
We knew what was going to happen in Michigan. We have a gentleman who used to come on a regular basis to see his grandchildren who came to the rotunda. So he would keep us up on Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
For people to get the real story, you go to www.bluecheddar.net.
Mm-hmm.
That's bluecheddar.net. Also, CBN was there. I guess on Friday, there is a YouTube from the Canadian Broadcasting Network.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jenna Pope on Facebook, she's an independent photojournalist. She has pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And you could YouTube anything about the Capitol, Madison, Wisconsin, give the dates last week, and you'll come up with many videos.
Wow.
We need support.
Yeah, okay. So what can people do, Catherine?
Well, if they go to the Solidarity Sing-Along page, there is a fund for the tickets. These are all...
How do you find that page?
On Facebook, there's a Solidarity Sing-Along
okay.
page. So if you friend it, and you should be able to find it. But also in Blue Cheddar, I'll have that person.
BlueCheddar.net.
Yeah, I'll have them put something up on their site about how people can help. If you can come here. Oh, I forgot to tell you. Also, watching is subject to arrest. They were telling tourists last week, and that's on YouTube, that if they kept watching, they would be under arrest also.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
He told her, we're tourists. She said, well, you know, they said, yeah, anything that's happened during the sing-along is subject to arrest. Last week we had some of the Democrats there. Of course, they were not arrested.
Yeah. When the Great Depression hit the United States, we had FDR. Italy had Mussolini. Germany had Hitler. Scott Walker and Mussolini, in my mind, are not that far apart. This is absolutely creepy. And yes, you're right. He is running for president, and the Koch brothers are going to throw as much money as they can, and other billionaires. I mean, we live now in billionaire-istan. It's the DeVos family in Michigan. It's Mr. Pope in North Carolina. Amazing. Catherine, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The United States of Billionaire-istan. Check out nobillionaires.com. Media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. And Ken in Detroit, Michigan, listening on Sirius.com. Hey, Ken, Smedley Butler's birthday, really?
Yes, before I get into Smedley Butler's birthday, I really want to comment on the guy, the conservative who thought that Obama was a Marxist.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us think Obama is an Eisenhower Republican.
Yes, count me among them. And in fact, I don't think he's enough of an Eisenhower Republican. Eisenhower actually bragged about increasing unionization by over a million people. Eisenhower bragged about raising the number of people who were on Social Security and the amount of Social Security benefits. I don't hear President Obama pushing card check. You know, it's I would like him to be more of an Eisenhower Republican.
You're probably right.
Anyway.
The reason I was calling was it is Smedley Butler's birthday, and I think it should be recognized. Smedley Butler was a U.S. Marine Major General in the 1930s.
And arguably the most famous military official in American history, other than maybe Ulysses Grant and George Washington, in the 1930s.
Yeah, and he may have been the savior of American democracy. There was a plot by a number of businessmen, including Prescott Bush, George Bush, George H.W.'s father, and a number of other major American industrialists who were opposed to Roosevelt and were trying to organize a coup against Roosevelt.
Mm.
And they wanted Smedley Butler to be the instrument of that coup, and instead he basically went to Congress and testified in a committee exposing them.
Yep.
And I just thought on his birthday he should be recognized.
Yeah, very well. Well done. He also wrote a book called War is a Racket, and it is to this day worth reading. I mean, he talks about how he went to war during the Spanish-American War and in World War One, not so much World War One, but, you know, he talks about the Spanish-American War, going to the Philippines and all these things on behalf of the racketeers. And he was a very, very good guy, Smedley Butler. He is missed. So thank you for that, Ken. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening. Paul in Sparta, Wisconsin. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Oh, I'm also sitting here while I'm listening to you. I'm watching C-SPAN.
Wow.
For the Senate.
You're like mainlining media.
Yeah. Tom Cruise, Mike Lee, Rubio, Tom Corbin are all sitting here talking about how in 62 days they're going to shut the government down because they don't like Obamacare.
Right.
Okay. It's been passed. It's been done. What they need to do is they need to find a way to make it a single-payer system like the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what, the main reason why these guys can do this is because most Americans, and this, I lay the responsibility of this at the feet of the Obama administration, most Americans don't realize that Obamacare has been in place for several years, that you can't get kicked off your insurance if you get sick now because of Obamacare, that you, if you do get seriously sick and you hit your lifetime limit like my wife did while she was going through cancer therapy, you can't get kicked off because of Obamacare, that if you're, you know, kids are over 21, they can't get kicked off your policy up until 26 because of Obamacare, that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's all kinds of good stuff that's already happened. And the insurance companies can't skim more than 20% of the money that you send them to pay for executive salaries and you know, parties in the Bahamas because of Obamacare. It used to be they'd skim 30, 40, 50%. So, you know, but the official rollout date for the you must buy insurance is October 1st, and that's the date that these guys are trying to make everybody think when Obamacare comes into effect. And of course, it's, you know, it's already been around for a while, but that's very interesting, because John McCain and the others are saying, nah, we're not going to pay any attention to these guys.
Well, but my point is that they're standing on the Senate floor doing this with a lapel pin on. It's a flag that says I'm a great American, but I'm willing to destroy the country because I want my party in office, and
right.
I don't like the guy that's there now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, that was the Republican conspiracy with Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, Jim DeMint, and company on the evening that Barack Obama was sworn into office. Excellent point. Paul, thanks for calling and making it. Joe in Chino, California. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi. Well, since Peter Ferrer's on, it's my cue to call in.
Okay.
I called in that one time when he was talking about, you know, just keep your money in the stock market, and I lost all mine because I had to retire.
Right. Ouch.
We've had you know, he's talking about socialist Obama. We've had wealth redistribution for the last 30 years under Reaganomics.
Yes, 32 years.
You know, these guys ran about, you know, wealth redistribution. It's fine as long as it's working to their favor.
Mm-hmm.
Also, just as an aside, when I was in kindergarten, my primary caretaker was my great-grandmother, and I went to a minority school. And my parents had to go in for a conference with my teacher because when I grew up, I wanted to be a trash man.
I remember being a little kid, you know, maybe 5-6 years old, and sitting in the window watching the garbage guys collect stuff and telling my dad that I wanted to be a garbage collector when I grew up. I thought that was just the coolest thing.
Well, I heard you on that program, and that made me laugh out loud.
Yeah.
You know, people were staring.
I'm guessing a lot of little boys had that experience, because it just kind of looks like, hey, you get to be outdoors and throw stuff around and make a lot of noise at 6 a.m. and have a good time. So.
Well, I was thinking more seriously along those lines since I was...
And if, Joe, if I may just interrupt you very briefly.
Sure.
And those garbage guys were always smiling and singing and talking each other up, because back in the 50s when I was a little kid, they were getting union wages. They could raise a family being a garbage man. I mean, nowadays they're not so much smiling, but back then it was a good job.
Well, since I was one of two white kids in a minority, you know, Latino school, because I didn't go to my neighborhood school because my great grandmother was my caretaker.
Mm-hmm.
I've often wondered if another kid in my class had wanted to be a trash man, would they have been so distraught?
The parents?
Boy that wants to be a trash man.
Yeah, well, it would depend.
The kindergarten teacher.
Oh, the kindergarten teacher. I see. Oh, you mean like she was looking at you like, oh, the loss of white potential sort of thing?
Yeah.
The racism that's built into our society and our cultural biases. Yeah, I get it.
I'm
tragic.
You know, I'm assuming that's, you know, kind of where it was, because, you know, obviously I don't know what was in that my teacher's mind. But,
right. Well, the reality is, particularly 20, 30, 40 years ago, all the more so, but it's still today, that white people still have, I mean, they're literally born with an edge, with the white privilege, with an advantage. And, you know, it's something that we've got to correct. We've got to do everything we can to fix this situation. But it's real.
I've had an experience of being a minority, you know, with blonde hair on the playground. I stood out.
Yeah.
You could always find me.
Yeah.
And like I said, the other white kid in the school is my brother.
Mm.
But, you know, I've been on the other end of racial discrimination because there were people who hated me just because I was white.
Mm.
But I also had a lot of friends that had Latino last names.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, there were a lot of people in that neighborhood that were really nice to me.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know. Joe, I got to move along, but thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story. Glenn in Cary, Illinois. Hey, Glenn, what's up? Glenn? No, Glenn. Okay. Harry in Providence, Rhode Island. Harry, what's on your mind?
Yeah, Tom, I would like to disagree with you about Obama's corporate tax rollback.
Mm-hmm.
Based on what I've actually learned from you in the past about this. You mentioned that this was Kennedy's bargain was take out all these loopholes and in exchange for a lower corporate tax rate. I remember
personal tax rate back in
I remember
Kennedy's.
You saying that did I get that wrong?
No, it was Kennedy did it with personal taxes. He changed the corporate tax rate somewhat, but it was mostly personal taxes. Obama is proposing to do it with corporate taxes.
Yeah, and as I recall, you mentioned that during the Reagan administration, he lowered the corporate tax rate tremendously, apparently in part in exchange for closing out loopholes. Is that right?
I don't have at the tip of my tongue or fingers or mind the details of what Reagan did with the corporate tax rate. The corporate tax rate has been not so much reduced over the years, and I don't think, frankly, that Reagan did reduce it as much as it's had holes drilled in it. It's so full of Swiss cheese. It's like Swiss cheese right now. It's so full of holes that General Electric and Apple make, you know, billions or hundreds of millions and, well, billions in profits. ExxonMobil, tens of billions in profits and pay not a single penny. In fact, they get a refund. So, yeah. You know, but what Reagan did with the personal income tax rate was it was set at 74% or 70%, where Johnson set it. Kennedy died and didn't see his, the fruition of his own proposal. But it was set in 64 by LBJ at 70%, and Reagan dropped it below that magical 50% threshold that stabilizes economies, the personal and federal income tax rate, top marginal rate, only paid by millionaires. And he dropped that down to 28%. It has since risen up to 30, I think it's 39% right now.
Okay, so it's been the personal tax
38%,
rate.
38%, yeah.
My concern is that if Obama gets this to work and Republicans put it through, sometime in, it'll be great short term, but in the next 5 to 10 years, Republicans and the corporate Democrats will get together and
they'll start drilling the holes in it again.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah. Harry, I share your concern. But something's got to be done. We got to start closing these loopholes. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the fact of the matter is, I doubt there's a company in America that's paying 35%. I mean, there might be a few, but it's so easy not to. I'd be astounded. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person, and dare to say, no, don't think so. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan.
Just like I'm wearing.
Just like you're wearing, yep. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen, so what's going on in the world?
Well, you've talked about Bradley Manning, I'm sure.
Yes.
So, okay, I don't need to go through that.
Yeah, in fact, we had your brother on.
Oh, okay.
Michael. Yeah.
That was good enough. In the Chutzpah Award, Gaul is how it translates from Yiddish. John Boehner just issued something today called 7 Ways President Obama's Policies Are Hurting American Manufacturers. First thing he talks about is blocking the Keystone Pipeline. Okay, I mean, we all know that it's not, but...
Right, they've been building it all
right,
this time.
Right, right. I mean, all right. This is the one that really gets me. Threatening a government shutdown over more tax hikes. Wait a minute. Wasn't it the Republicans that are threatening the government shutdown? He's saying that Obama, he said, the White House is spoiling for a government shutdown.
It's interesting. I was the other night, I think it was whatever night it was, Louise and I were channel surfing, and we hit Sean Hannity, and he had some liberal on, and he said, or maybe it was a couple of conservatives. In any case, he says, is Obama going to shut down the government over this? And they were like, yeah, looks like he might. I mean, it's like, I felt like I'd stepped into another dimension.
It's the craziest thing I've ever heard of.
Yeah.
I mean, Obama, it's the Republicans that are shutting down the government.
Or threatening
I can't
too.
Even,
yeah.
Whatever. Okay. Yeah. So now, 3 things today. U.S. Department of Transportation is going after, and they after Southwest Airlines. Apparently, they've been fined only $200,000 for doing a one-way fare of $100 or less and a $66 one-way seat to Dallas and Branson, Missouri, but it had no seats available.
Oh, in other words, teaser fares that for which
that
there
don't
is,
exist
yeah.
Exactly. Uh-oh. And Senator Wyden in your former state talked about a $400 million settlement with J.P. Morgan. This is because a manipulation of electricity markets in California and the Midwest.
That's a good thing.
Yes. This is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission did that. And also, Chuck Schumer had legislation that got passed committee today. Apparently, you cannot sell a car that has been recalled if you're doing it on the open market or, your car manufacturer. But you can do it if you are a rental car company. And so they want to close that loophole.
Whoa.
And apparently even the car manufacturers are behind the Schumer legislation on this.
That's a good idea. One of our kids, we bought a car for her when she graduated from high school, and it was a used car, and we bought it from one of the rental car companies. They sell used cars.
Right.
And we thought, we'll get a car that's been well-maintained, that the rental car companies would maintain it well. But you're saying, no, not so much. It might even be a recalled car.
That's right. And apparently some people were killed. And it was the law is named after Rachel and Jacqueline Hauk. Safe Rental Car Act because two girls were killed.
Wow.
Yeah,
incredible.
Pretty unbelievable. Okay, so the president today gave a talk with which John Boehner apparently and others went right after, talking about a better bargain for the middle class. And this is his initiatives. They want to eliminate loopholes while by making the tax dollars for business no more than 28%. It's currently 35%. They want to simplify tax forms for small businesses, including if you and I were to make an investment like we had this money of $1 million, we'd be able to simplify our tax form on that. I wish we had $1 million to make that investment, but okay, I guess some small businesses do.
Right.
A manufacturing tax rate of no higher than 25%, and then incentives for people not to locate their business overseas. They also want to build America's infrastructure. That's what he talked about, and a modernization of schools, and then use community colleges to train workers for the future. Now, as you know, I worked after Katrina in Mississippi, and I saw what the community colleges, because they're small, they can turn on a dime, they trained people, and they can do that in this economy as well.
Yeah.
And so the president wants to really push that in terms of having community college be that first stop for training new workers.
When I read the speech, I heard part of it, but I read the whole thing. And my thought was, and in fact, I'm going to go off on a riff on this tonight on television, is that he's doing what Jack Kennedy did in 62 and 63. You know, he said, you know, the top tax rate on millionaires was 90%. Jack Kennedy said, I'm a millionaire. I know nobody pays that.
Right.
You know, let's drop it to 70% and close the loopholes. And federal tax revenue from rich people went from $63 million in 1963 or 64, the year that was passed, to over $180 million just well, I think 5 years later.
By quote unquote closing the loophole.
That's correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And dropping the tax rate.
That's right. So
exactly.
I think Obama's trying to pull a Jack Kennedy, and I wish him well on it, actually.
Okay. So now the peace talks are happening, the Palestinian-Israeli peace talks. My cousin Aaron David Miller's been all over the news on all of this because he was one of the negotiators.
Mm.
It is the Justice Minister Livni and also Erkat, I guess is the guy's name, from the Palestinian. They apparently said that they together said today that they believe that they are going to resolve this without exceptions. And then Livni said it's not our intention to argue about the past, but to create solutions and make decisions for the future. More power to Secretary Kerry on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
Your cousin is one of the negotiators?
He used to be.
Oh,
he
wow.
negotiated, I think he was involved in Camp David.
Wow.
25 years he spent at the State Department. He left under Bush 43 because he felt like they weren't exactly moving in the right direction, and they weren't.
Yeah. Huh. Remarkable.
Okay. Republican donors, they're lobbying for immigration reform. This is not my story. That is a story, actually. One of the news services other than us did this one, so I'd like to mention it, and actually the Washington Post talked about it this morning. But there is a group of Republicans led by former Secretary, Commerce Secretary Carlos Guterres, and they want to Republicans for immigration reform, and they are pushing Republicans to do that. Clearly, there's a business interest.
Good, yeah, absolutely. And good luck with that. We'll see how that works out. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The president gave a speech today, and there's a couple of pieces of it that I'd like to share with you that I think are particularly important. The first is he's calling out the Republicans. Let us not forget that back in 2009, January 2009, the night that President Obama was inaugurated, when he was sworn into office, that night he and his wife and Joe Biden and his wife were out dancing, you know, with the stars, as it were, in all these balls all around Washington, D.C. And Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker were meeting at a restaurant here in Washington, D.C. to plot the destruction of the Obama presidency at the caucus room restaurant in a private room, along with Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich, who has discussed it with me on this program. Newt Gingrich has. Said, yeah, that's what you do. If you're going to take out the opposition, that's why it's called the opposition. You take them out. So these guys got together to take down the Obama presidency. And, you know, they have been working aggressively to harm the economy by blocking everything the president's been trying to do. And their compatriots, their Republican compatriots in the states all around the United States, the 50 states, or at least the ones that are run by Republicans, have been quite successful in knocking several hundred thousand people out of work. So it's like the Republicans, you know, from you know, it's over 700,000 jobs that have been lost at the state level. The sequester, we're looking at losing maybe 800,000, and in fact, he's talking about even 900,000 being lost next year, just next year, 900,000 jobs. So this is the paragraph that starts with worse, right, Shano? Yeah. So here's the president speaking about these policies. You know, if they're trying to shut down the government, they're trying to shut down Obamacare, they're trying to do everything they can to defeat everything, and they're basically what the Republicans are doing and have been doing for 6 years now, 5 years now, is make the American people hurt so bad that they will start noticing how much it hurts, and then Republicans run around, and they're particularly good at doing this on Fox News, and yell, it's all the president's fault. Here's President Obama on this.
And these moves don't just hurt our economy in the long term, they hurt our middle class right now. The independent Congressional Budget Office estimates that the cuts that are being made right now in Washington will cost our economy 750,000 jobs this year, 900,000 fewer jobs next year. And a lot of the jobs at risk are at small businesses that contract with our military or our federal agencies. Over the past 4 years, another 700,000 workers at the federal, state, and local levels of government have lost their jobs. These are cops and firefighters. About half of them are people who work in our schools. Those are real jobs. It doesn't help a company like Amazon when a teacher or a cop or a firefighter loses their job. They don't have money to place an order. That's hundreds of thousands of customers who have less money to spend. If those layoffs had not happened, if public sector employees grew like they did the past two recessions, the unemployment rate would be 6.5 instead of 7.5. Our economy would be much better off, and the deficit would still be going down because we'd be getting more tax revenue.
So, you know, very simple. He just lays it out. I mean, I would have liked him to, every other sentence, say, because of Republicans, because of Republican policies, because of Republican intransigence, because of the Republican conspiracy to destroy my presidency, whatever. I mean, I would like him to have pointed it out a little more literally or specifically or explicitly, but I think, and that's frankly, I think, is, you know, for the entire 5 years of his presidency, has been one of the messaging challenges that the Obama administration has had, is that he has tried so hard to look to the average American as somebody who is willing to work with the other side, as somebody who is post-partisan. He's tried so hard to be reasonable that a lot of people are starting to believe the lie. You know, you throw enough stuff against the wall and some of it sticks. They're starting to believe the lies that are being spread, that this bad economy is a consequence of decisions that this president and the Democratic Party made, when in fact it is the exact opposite. This economy is in large part the consequence of policy decisions that were made in the name of Reaganomics. 32 years of Reaganomics has hollowed out the core of this country. Free trade has hollowed out the industrial core of this country. We're being wiped out. And we're still living in a Reaganomics world. You know, the top tax rate is still below 50%. You want to put an end to Reaganomics. You got to roll back the Reagan tax cuts, and nobody's talking about that, except me. You got to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. You've got to start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and start breaking up big companies again, like Richard Nixon initiated with AT&T. and thus provide space in the business ecosystem for small businesses and medium-sized businesses, for entrepreneurs. And you've got to have a national trade policy that puts America first. So, you know, we're not going in those directions, but there's a little step. Now, in the meantime, we've got a corporate tax rate of 35%, and the Republicans are running around screaming all the time, oh, my God, we've got the highest corporate tax rate in the developed world, which is true. It's actually the second highest. But nobody pays 35%. Corporations, on average in the United States, pay 11%. That's what's called the effective income tax, corporate income tax rate, 11%. So let's drop it down to 28% and close some of these loopholes so that GE and Apple and ExxonMobil, who paid not one penny in income taxes for the last half a dozen years, will begin paying taxes. And here's President Obama talking about doing that.
Just tax breaks. Right now, everybody knows this. Our tax code is so riddled with loopholes and special interest tax breaks that a lot of companies who are doing the right thing and investing in America pay 35% in their taxes. Corporations who've got fancy accountants and stash their money overseas, they pay little or nothing in taxes. That's not fair. And it's not good for the economy here. So, I'm willing to simplify our tax code, closes those loopholes, ends incentives to ship jobs overseas, lowers the rate for businesses that are creating jobs right here in America, provides tax incentives for manufacturers that bring jobs home to the United States. Let's simplify taxes for small business owners, give them incentives to invest so they can spend less time filling out complicated forms, more time expanding and hiring. I'm willing to do all that. That should help businesses and help them grow. But if we're going to give businesses a better deal, then we're also going to have to give workers a better deal, too.
There you go. And then he talks about, let's take some of this money and use it for infrastructure and things like that, because he actually is talking about increasing the revenue coming into the federal government, just like Jack Kennedy did. When Jack Kennedy, Kennedy actually proposed it in 1962, in 1963, in his State of the Union address, in 1963, he gave several speeches. One of the probably the most famous was to the Commercial Club of New York, as I recall, the Commerce Club of New York, whatever, and their Economic Club. And he didn't live to see it. LBJ passed it in 1964, but it dropped the top tax rate from 91% down to 70%, and in the process closed so many loopholes that rich people like Jack Kennedy actually started paying taxes. And you saw federal tax collections go from in the neighborhood of $60 billion from the income tax on rich people, go from the neighborhood of $60 billion in 64 to over $150 billion by the end of that decade, just 6 years later. So it worked. It wasn't the tax cut. It was the closing of it, because nobody was paying those top rates. It was the closing of loopholes. So then Reagan came along and said, well, gee, the tax cut worked. Let's do it again. Oh, that didn't work so well. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So if Obama can pull off a Jack Kennedy, I'll be genuinely impressed. We'll see. I think these Republicans won't even go along with that. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So, will President Obama be successful in pulling a Jack Kennedy out of the hat? You know, back when Jack Kennedy was alive, you could actually talk to Republicans. They actually cared about the future of our country. They cared about working people. Their ideas might have been different. Their perspectives may have been different. They were still, very much the party of the rich and powerful and of the corporate class. But they understood that without a middle class buying goods in the United States, you didn't have an economy, and that hurt rich people. The Republicans were able to abandon that in the 1980s with Reaganomics, with the free trade, the permanent normal trade relations, the most favored nation status, the beginning of these early trade agreements that, then in the 90s, of course, NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, the whole bunch of them. That gave the Republicans the ability to change their tune. Prior to the Reagan administration, pro-corporate Republicans, and they were unabashedly, unashamedly so. They were the fat cats. They were proud of it. But they also said, let's pay the workers a decent wage. Let's negotiate with the unions. Let's have an economy that works so that we have a strong middle class who will buy our stuff and make us rich. That was the perspective that the Republicans had back then. Once our economy got internationalized, once they no longer needed to worry about American consumers buying their stuff, Microsoft, Apple, I mean, you name the company, General Motors, they do, many of these companies, I think all of the companies I just named, are probably doing more business overseas than in the United States. They're selling all across South America. They're selling all across Europe. They're selling all across Africa. They're selling to Australia. They're selling, all across Asia. These are no longer American companies looking at an American market. And because they're no longer American companies, the Business Roundtable, the CEOs of the 100 largest corporations, the American Chamber of Commerce, they're no longer saying, hey, let's have a strong middle class. Let's have unions. Let's have a good, healthy minimum wage. Keep in mind, Republicans used to support this stuff because they needed consumers. They no longer give a rat's ass about American consumers. They don't care anymore. And so now it's just a matter of, hey, let's suck everything out that we can from the middle class. Let's just devastate this country. When it all crashes, we're sitting on tons and tons of cash, they're saying to themselves. I mean, they're doing it. Right now, corporations are sitting on more cash than at any time in world history. Right now, rich people are hoarding more cash than at any time in world history. Why? Because when the crash comes, they're going to step in and buy everything. It's happening right now in Greece. Privatize the Parthenon. Privatize everything. Privatize the water supplies. Privatize the septic systems. The sewage. Privatize the airports. Everything is going to be an opportunity for rich fat cats and corporations to get richer. It's just totally bizarre. So anyhow, let's pick up some of your thoughts on this. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Yes, good afternoon, Tom. That guy, what's his name, Peter Ferrer?
Yeah, in the last hour, who was talking about Obama being a Kenyan socialist, yes.
Yeah, you know, he's one of the people that I consider like being a right-wing zombie, you know, with the talking points. Just, you know, he's taking the talking points right out of the Republican playbook. And most of the things he was saying were not based in reality. But what I really wanted to talk about was,
the NSA?
This thing about what Obama proposed today.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
First of all, the Republicans are not going to go for it because, like you just said, they want to make sure that the economy stays depressed, and they figure that that will help them to take power. So they don't care about the American people,
right,
and job creation. And the corporations are just fine with the way things are now.
Yeah, corporate profits are at the highest point in the history of the planet Earth.
Right. So, I mean, the corporations don't care about job creation right now. All they care about is corporate profits. And Republicans are determined to stop any type of economic growth.
Yep.
But you have the right-wing people who just continue to believe what they say, even though they're proving that they have no intentions on making this economy better.
Yeah. Yeah, you listen to Fox News, you listen to these right-wing commentators. Peter was doing it when he was on the show. And they go off on, you know, this is the worst economic recovery we've seen since 1929. This is the worst, you know, this economy, blah, blah, blah. And they tick off the points. You know, the real unemployment is actually 18%. You know, when Bernie Sanders talks about those things, he's complaining about them and saying we need to do something to fix these things. When Republicans talk about those things, or Fox so-called news talks about those things, they are bragging about their accomplishments.
But you know what, Tom? The Democrats also are zombie-like.
Not all of them. Not all of them.
For Say that again?
Not all of them.
For instance?
Jan Schakowsky, Raul Grijalva. I see. You wanted to give it for instance. I thought you were asking me for examples.
No. The Democrats, Obama's basically an eight-year lame duck president. Okay, you have Democrats like Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer, Harry Reid. They go into a back room and decide that they're going to do nothing about the Senate filibuster.
Yeah, well, they're sort of in the middle. I mean, the ones that you really have to be more concerned about are the Mary Landrieu types, you know, the conservadems.
But people like Senator Merkley in Oregon.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
He came out and started naming names about the people who didn't want to change the filibuster.
Yeah, you're right. And they slapped him down for it. You're absolutely right, Wayne. Wayne, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT there in Chicago. We'll be right back. It is 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So what did John Boehner say about the offer, the John Kennedy offer that Barack Obama made today? I'll tell you after the break. Very, very questuarily ugly, the good. The Mall of America. On Thursday, same-sex couples can start legally marrying in Minnesota. To honor the occasion, the Mall of America, the largest mall in the United States, will host a midnight wedding ceremony for Holly Bartlett and Amy Petrick. The couple will be the first same-sex pair to tie the knot under Minnesota's new law. Good work, Mall of America, and congratulations to the happy couple. The bad. Fox Business Channel. On Monday, the network introduced Richard Berman as an expert on the fast food industry during a discussion of this week's fast food strike on Barney & Company. Check this out.
Rick Berman from the Employment Policy Institute joins us now. Rick, spell it out. What do you mean? If you get $15 an hour, in comes the iPad to do it for nothing?
What Fox Business didn't tell its viewers is that Richard Berman isn't really an objective source. He's a lobbyist with deep ties to the fast food industry, and that Employment Policy Institute that he works for, it's funded almost entirely by big businesses and receives a lot of money from the restaurant industry. Just another day in the life of Fox so-called news and its spinoff networks. And the very, very ugly Brooke Goldstein. During a recent appearance on the Fox News show Red Eye, the Lawfare Project scholar offered her, well, interesting take on New York City mayoral candidate Anthony Weiner's relationship with his wife, Huma Abedin.
The real question, why is Weiner so unattracted to Huma Abedin?
Oh, why?
Why? Perhaps it's because she is connected with Islamists who want to kill us. Perhaps it's because her family members are part and parcel of the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, I completely agree with Andy McCarthy that she poses one of the greatest national security threats to this administration.
Amazing. Goldstein's employer, by the way, the Lawfare Project, is a thinly veiled front for Islamophobes. And it's frankly disturbing to hear that brand of hateful lies on a supposedly fair and balanced major cable news channel. It's very, very ugly. It's amazing. Amazing. Rich in Philadelphia. Reverse racism, Rich? Really?
Yeah, Tom. Good to talk with you. You know, I agree with you on about 90% of issues.
But
when it came to the whole Trayvon Martin thing, you've been way, way off. And you've been trying to put white guilt on everybody. And it's just, there's a lot of reverse racism going on out there. And, you know, I'll give you a few examples. Number one, affirmative action hiring in government. Another thing, I live in Chicago partially of the year, you know, and there's these, you know, wilding attacks that are going on downtown where a bunch of black thugs take a couple white tourists and they beat them up and rob them. I mean, they're targeted because they're white. You know, that's reverse racism.
So it must just be that black people are violent? Is that it?
Well, Tom, that's part of it. It's a whole culture. It starts
seriously
with, you know, the music. Single mothers, that doesn't help either.
Right.
You know, I'm trying to...
You know, more white people commit crimes in this country than black people, Rich.
Yeah, well, per capita, Tom, it's out of control. And you know,
well, you have more poverty in the black community, Rich.
And I can give you a prime example.
You have more poverty in the black community, Rich.
Tom, I've heard you say that with the poverty. And
it is true.
I don't buy it because you think about it. Look at Africa. Africa's loaded with natural resources, gold, diamond mines. They have
Africa was colonized by white Europeans right up until 1956. If you expect people to go from being colonized to being fully developed Western civilizations. I mean, how long did it take Europe to figure this out? About 2,000 years. It takes a while. It takes more than one or two generations to put a country back together, Rich.
Yeah, but why were they colonized? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Can't they just do their, you know, their own thing? I mean, why were they colonized in the first place?
So do you think that Native Americans are also an inferior race because whites were able to kill them off?
No, Tom, you're good. You're totally changing the subject on me now.
Well, no, you're saying. I mean, if we're identifying races that and saying that they're inherently something wrong with them because they're not being economically successful in the face of white colonization, Native Americans are really
Let's bring it back to this country, okay? You say poverty breeds violence. I hear you.
No, I'm saying racism. Yeah, poverty breeds violence.
John Boehner's district, the 18th or 20th district in Ohio, is very, very poor. He has a poor district. He's rich in a poor district. But
Rich, I can't debate John Boehner's district with you. I'm sorry. I don't know anything about it. But what I do know is that the position that you're taking is the position that white racists take who don't realize that they're racist. I'm guessing that you probably think that you're not a racist.
I bike through neighborhoods of Chicago all the time.
Oh, yeah. Some of your best friends are black, right, Rich?
Say again?
Some of my best friends are black? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
No, you don't understand. Okay, reverse racism is black on white racism.
That's not reverse racism. That's simply black people attacking white people, which is really, really rare. The vast majority of black criminals and black victims are black. Even this idea of black on black crime. What are we, when white people attack white people, do we call it white on white crime?
Tom, do you think it's fair that your tax dollars?
Did you say that Tim McVeigh blowing up the
extra lunches for black neighborhoods and all this extra stuff for black neighborhoods? Do you think that's fair that mine and your tax dollars go to that?
Because they're black people.
I disagree.
Because they're black people, Rich.
No, Tom, it has nothing to do with that.
Rich, you're revealing a really, really ugly side of yourself.
They're not stepping up to the plate. The wealthy black people are not stepping up and helping out other black people.
How do you know that, Rich?
Why is he not in Detroit? Why is he not helping out the poor and needy in Detroit? He's totally turned his back on that, just like his own neighborhood in Chicago.
So one rich black guy isn't helping out a city that is faltering, and it's got
to
be.
So many of them like that. They just turn their back on their own neighborhoods and stuff like that. It's not fair. I mean, it's.
Rich, I have to believe that you really believe this, and I think that's so sad that you really are talking like the white racists that I used to know in Michigan who were actually quite open about their racism, who and particularly bringing up Africa and see there's proof of it and that kind of thing. I mean, you really need to if you're going to talk about this stuff, you should spend a little bit of time studying the history of race in the United States and around the world, frankly, and of European colonization. And anyway, I've made my point. Mike in Mountain View, Hawaii. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Yeah, hi. I wanted to talk to you about, you had that religious ruling today, and we got a cannabis pastor over here on the Big Island that has been in jail for 3 years with no trial, and they're saying right now, today, in front of Leslie Ann Kobayashi, a federal judge in Hawaii, they're deciding on whether or not he can even bring up the religious defense.
Right. That's not uncommon. I mean, we went through that with peyote in the 60s and 70s with Native Americans in the West.
Concerning that they can claim a religion is bunk when they really don't have a yardstick for determining what is a bunk religion.
Right. Yeah. Or what is a sacrament for a religion. I don't disagree with you, Mike, but I wish the pastor in Hawaii well. Sharon in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Hi. I just have a question that I don't know if anyone knows what kind of family members people like the Koch brothers have, or the people who are pushing all the climate change denying, or the people who are in charge of fracking and all our environmental laws. But as a recovering alcoholic many years ago in AA, there was a question asked that I would love to ask them in a different format. The question that this person proposed was, if you feel like taking a drink, go look your child in the eyes and tell them that you hate them.
Mm.
So my question to these people would be, and I wish I could get this question to them, if they have grandchildren, children, any kind of loved one, as you want to destroy the earth with your policies, please first go look in the eyes of your beloved and tell them that you hate them.
Yeah. Here's the problem, Sharon. These folks have enough money that they can hire people to tell them what they want to hear. John Kenneth Galbraith, the economist, advisor to Franklin Roosevelt, probably one of the most famous economists in history, famously said, the modern conservative, and this was back in the 30s, he said, the modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy, that is, the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness. And this is what happens. I mean, this is the conversation I had with Mark Morano, who's probably one of the most egregious of the climate deniers. He's really, really out there all over the place. He travels all over the world, speaks at conferences, you know, pushes this stuff. He's very, very well paid and does a really, really good job. He's a very efficient communicator for the side that says that there's no such thing as global warming, if you want to call that a side. And I just asked him, you know, how do you sleep at night? And he's like, I've got, you know, science on my side. I've got, you know, I've got the facts and figures. I can sleep well at night. And I, either he's a, you know, not to pick on Mark specifically, but, you know, either those, that category of folks, either they're sociopaths or they actually believe the stuff that they get, or both.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge that we have with them. And this is the challenge that we have in a country where, you know, increasingly the economy has been taken over by sociopaths. But excellent question, Sharon. Thank you. And excellent comment. Somebody needs to do an intervention. Now, I don't know enough about AA to know what that really means, but I've seen it on television. It looked pretty good. Somebody needs to do an intervention with these guys. 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And once again, Bradley Manning is officially not a traitor. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Gabriel in Boise, Idaho. Hey, Gabriel, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Originally I had a question about Bradley Manning, but you answered it in the meantime.
Okay.
So I'm going to make a comment on something I heard that I think a lot of people could use a little insight on.
Mm-hmm.
First, when it comes to racism, I hear a lot of people mix up racism and poverty.
Mm-hmm.
They use the wrong definitions.
Yeah, they confuse race for poverty.
And they don't understand the long-term side effects of hate.
Or oppression, yes.
There's an entire study on that. I mean, and to give you an idea of the little bit of insight I've had, my Oma was a Hitler youth. She actually shook Hitler's hand before, you know, on a couple of occasions. Her father worked on the jet fuel project for the V-2 rocket.
Wow.
And my father's side of the family were Jews in Germany that died in concentration was fighting for the American army in the Battle of the Bulge. So seeing it from all kinds of angles, and I'm telling you, there is no victor in hate.
Yeah.
There is no victor in any type of passive approach to people that give excuses for hate.
Yeah. Gabriel, very, very well said. Thank you for the call, and thank you for sharing that. I refer people to David Swanson's book, War is a Lie. It's a brilliant a brilliant analysis of a lot of these issues. Nate in Denver. Hey, Nate, thanks for listening to AM 760. What's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for your show. And I'm sorry to clutter it up, but Zimmerman was brought back up again, and someone needs to do a cartoon with the Three Stooges backing up to each other, each holding their gun, right?
Mm-hmm.
When they all turn around, they're all defending their ground, and all three of them are dead.
Right.
I mean, that is such, that ALEC law is such a stupid...
Anyway,
you just think of the Three Stooges. I mean, I can't get any
okay, stupid. You got it. Stand your grounds. Three. Good metaphor. Thank you, Nate. Alan in Albuquerque, listening on KABQ. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Tom, let me run this by you. I'm thinking that Obama's going to give the Democrats Keystone and vote against it, you know, because of all the problems they're having up there in Canada, what's leaking anyway, and he's going to look like the great environmentalist. But he's going to give the Republicans in Wall Street Summers, Larry Summers.
I don't think so. I think that he is getting so much blowback on even the idea of Larry Summers. I mean, the Democrats in the Senate now are saying no. I don't think that he's... I hope I'm right on this, Alan, because Larry Summers would
right
be it.
Too, but I've been thinking about this for a while, and I'm thinking Wall Street... gains on either side.
Of course, absolutely. But Wall Street gains, and not just Wall Street. You know, corporate America gains big if it's Larry Summers, and he's always been wrong on everything. He's just not only is he like a creepy manager and well, enough said. Alan, thank you for the call. I'm with you. Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard, thanks for listening to WCPT.
Well, hi. You had that fellow on who was talking about blacks being more violent, and the comment was Hitler. But aside from Hitler, this country had its hand on a button that would have killed all of the life on this planet, because the Soviet Union had centralized planning and we're a free market.
Right.
When I hear people talk about Africa, I mean, you're right, the influence of colonialism and also the disregard for the people on that continent through our economic policies. Has created poverty, which created a lot of the, like the Hutu mess, if you read Collapse by Jared Diamond, gives a whole different perspective on what went on there.
Yeah.
So when I hear these racists talk about this stuff, it's just infuriating. We had our hand on a button that killed everything on the planet.
Yeah, we're the ones who nuked Hiroshima. I mean, we're the one who killed 2 million Vietnamese. And if you want to make it about white people, you know, look at the Holocaust. Excellent point, Richard. Thank you for calling and making it. Jim in Chicago. Hey, Jim.
Tom, I'm a Detroiter originally. I love your show. I know you're going to end quick here. I just wanted to say I am sick and tired of white people using the term reverse racism.
There's no such thing.
Somebody would correct them. Exactly. And what they're saying is that black people can be discriminated by whites, but when whites are discriminated, it's reverse racism. It's so offensive even to hear it. I can't stand hearing it.
Yeah, because it you can only reverse racism if you reverse the balance of power between the races. And, you know, with the average African-American family in the United States having net worth of around $5,000 and the average white family in America having a net worth of around $86,000, there is an economic imbalance of power that is so large. There is a political imbalance of power that is so massive. You look at the number of black elected officials and how many states, statewide offices, how many, you know, states are run or governed by African Americans. Well said. Jim, thank you very much. Excellent point. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, we got 1 minute to the end of the show. It's yours.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to correct some of the false statements made by that so-called economist that you had on a while back. First, he said that President Obama doesn't care about middle-class jobs. Well, President Obama's policies of the stimulus, cash for clunkers, saving GM and Chrysler, all led to 5 million jobs being created and getting us out of the depression that the Republicans got us in.
Yep.
And since then, the Republicans have killed over 2 million jobs with budget cuts. So it's the Republicans that don't care about middle-class jobs.
Yeah.
And also, he said that the government wants people to be dependent. Well, that's the Republicans, because they insist on giving the oil companies $4 billion a year of our tax money, and they refuse to cut the military budget, so they want billionaires to be dependent on the government.
Yeah, and they're subsidizing the corn industry, the ag industry, and on it goes. Yeah, excellent point, Paul. Thank you for the call. And Coming up tomorrow, why are 4 out of 5 Americans facing a life of poverty? Could it be right-wing austerity policies? Maybe. I'll challenge conservative Dr. Carol Swain. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires your participation. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. I'll see you tomorrow.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.